Facebook.com.
Well, once again, everybody, thank you for joining me here on this Thursday, December 29th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next 90 minutes or so as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here for our Thursday mega show. We'll kick things off with Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com for this week's Powers Picks segment. Obviously, tons of college football to get to here with him. Also, chat a little bit of NFL Week 17. Coming up after that, we'll have Ralph Michaels from WagerTalk.com. We'll chat some college basketball with him. And to wrap up today's show, Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com with UFC 207. At least that's currently the plan. We had confirmed that yesterday, still waiting for final confirmation today. But in any event, lots of great stuff coming your way so that you can finish off 2016 on a high note. With that, we'll go ahead and get into things with today's first guest. That is Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com. Brad, how's it going today, my friend?
That's going well. I hope all is well back east there in beautiful northeast Ohio.
Yeah, well, there's no snow on the ground, so that's a good thing. You and I were talking before we got on the air here and started recording live, and I know that this is something that you've been following closely and something I saw you tweet about this morning here. We've had some very live, very loudly barking dogs here during the bowl season.
I mean, it's been incredible. 15-2 is the current run against the spread last 17 bowl games. They started, 3-4. You had like a Tulsa team crushing as a big favorite, crushing Central Michigan. So it wasn't a great look early on, but boy, they have really come on strong. And it's just not been against the spread, but obviously several outright upsets. I mean, Minnesota with 10 suspended players pulls a big outright upset. Idaho pulls an outright upset as the 2-touchdown underdog. Wake Forest, a big dog, although they probably shouldn't have been, in my opinion. They pull an outright upset. So, finally, after yesterday, I think we're starting to see the public finally starting to catch on. And, you and I were talking before the show, all three dogs today, as far as public betting percentages, looking like they're getting a majority of the action in the public markets. And, for a guy like myself that likes to play dogs, that starts to worry me. When I see the public starting to like underdogs, that starts to begin the time where you might want to start looking the other way. But with that being said, and I'm sure we'll talk these games today, I do like all three dogs today, but I guess I'm not as thrilled seeing that everyone's starting to jump on board at this point.
Well, we tried to cover the first two games here on Thursday on last week's segment. The only one that we didn't get to was the Alamo Bowl, and I figured this is a good one to throw a live bone to, or throw a bone to our live listeners and also to those that jump on the show shortly after it put up. And, this looks like, on paper at least, one of the more exciting bowl matchups. You got Oklahoma State and Colorado, an experienced offense for Oklahoma State, a really good secondary for Colorado. Of course, defensive coordinator Jim Leavitt heading on over to Oregon. So we'll see if there's any sort of drop-off from the Buffaloes. But Colorado's got a legit offense themselves.
No question that they do. I mean, it's an offense that's averaging 33 points per game. When Sifo Lufau is healthy, I mean, they're really dangerous. I mean, in each of their three losses this season, he's gotten a little bit banged up. I mean, everyone remembers the Michigan game. I mean, they were leading that game outright. He gets banged up in the second half. They end up losing the game by 17. So, yeah, there's no question about it, but I would say more than anything, the reason why Colorado's, won 10 games this year, it's the defense. I mean, you look at the last 2 years, the improvements they made, they have knocked off 19 points per game. I mean, just a couple years ago, this was a defense allowing nearly 40 points per game. I mean, that's a major reason why Leavitt got paid, and he's off to Oregon, which is a concern for Colorado here because they got a safeties coach in Joe Tumpkin that's going to call the defense. I think they're two evenly matched teams. I think Oklahoma State has the better offense. They average 39 points per game. Mason Rudolph, 25 touchdown passes, just 4 picks, averaging 315 passing yards per game. You know, Oklahoma State is, a team that's, a Hail Mary touchdown pass away from having 10 wins this year. Disappointing performance, with the Big 12 title on the line in the finale, but I like their coaching. I wouldn't say the coaching edge, but as far as their coaching experience edge, when it comes to prepping for bowl games, I like the overall team. I mean, they're used to playing in bowl games, 11 straight for them. Colorado hasn't played in a bowl since 2007. Slight crowd edge in Big 12 country there in San Antonio, Texas. And they also have the special teams edge. Add it all up, and I'm going to be taking the points. Oklahoma State +3 is the pick for me.
Now, I know we touched on this early in the season, but have you finally made the adjustment to Oklahoma State because of that phenomenal mullet of Mike Gundy?
No. You know, I was just starting to buy into it a little bit there, and, you know, they were a big disappointment yet again in Bedlam on the road at Oklahoma. So, no, he's got to get a Big 12 championship for me and, you know, a major bowl win. You know, I had that really good year back in 2010, but no upgrade as far as the power ratings for that Billy Ray Cyrus mullet.
That's fantastic. I absolutely love that thing. I'm rooting for Oklahoma State today solely because of that. Let's move to Friday here. And we've actually seen a movement on this game, the AutoZone Liberty Bowl in Memphis, Tennessee, between TCU and Georgia. This is one that really hadn't been touched for a while. It had kind of been sitting in that pick'em range almost since it opened. Now we've got TCU as a 2.5-point favorite.
Yeah, and, I wonder if it's market manipulation. They're wanting to get it to 3 so they come hot and heavy on Georgia. Or it could be, hey, the SEC didn't put out a good look in their first couple of bowl games. Mississippi State probably should have lost outright to Miami, Ohio. I thought Miami, Ohio was the better team almost entirely throughout that entire game, even at the line of scrimmage. Then, you know, Vanderbilt was a team that was basically a no-show against NC State. So I don't know if it's anti-Georgia and anti-SEC or if it's market manipulation, because, on the other side, it's awfully tough to get myself talked into a TCU ticket, a team that's, you know, came in with, you know, a lot of expectations this year. You thought the defense would be improved. You thought Kenny Hill would be the answer at quarterback. What do? They go 3-9 against the spread. No consistency whatsoever. It's tough making either team a favorite. I mean, they were combined, both teams, 4-12 against the number as a favorite this year, suffering 6 outright upsets. You know, TCU was a very poor favorite and didn't have a good look down the stretch. I mean, look at their last two home games, lose 31-6 to Oklahoma State, lose 30-6 to Kansas State. I think there's some coaching issues there for them. I think there's some disagreement, particularly between Gary Patterson, the head coach, and the way the offense was run this year. You know, Georgia, in my opinion, has got the slightly better defense. They obviously have the running back edge in this one. You add it all up, and obviously you do have to give the, you know, majority of the coaching edge to Patterson, because, you know, he's prepping for his 15th bowl game, Kirby Smart's first. So, you know, TCU has that in their favor. I got the game power rated about pick'em. So with the, I'm going to play against the line move here. Give me Georgia plus the points.
We'll move to the Sun Bowl here in El Paso between Stanford and North Carolina. And obviously both of these teams had some higher expectations for this year coming off of the seasons that they had the previous year. But they do meet here in this one, and, you know, no Christian McCaffrey for Stanford, no Elijah Hood for North Carolina. Actually seeing this number tick down below 3, I think it's the first time it's been under 3 in quite some time. Pinnacle and the Greek, two of the sharper offshores out there, now sitting 2.5. So a little bit of Tar Heel money coming in here.
Yeah, and it's actually a majority of the public. I was talking to the VP of CG Technology on Monday, and he said, it's mainly public-driven. He had a lot of Stanford money early on, and that was more sharp. The announcement of McCaffrey being out has led to the public showing up on North Carolina. I think they're going to miss McCaffrey, I think, in the return game. And obviously he's a dynamite player, number one in the country yet again, second year in a row in all-purpose yardage. But, you know, their backup, Love, averaged 6.4 yards per carry. He's out. McCaffrey was out for the Notre Dame game, and Love had a solid performance, over 100 yards there. So I don't think they're going to miss too much, at least not as much as what everyone's perceiving here. You know, obviously North Carolina has a significant edge at quarterback. Trubisky, 28 touchdown passes, 4 interceptions. Stanford just couldn't get solid quarterback play at all this season. Receiver edge to North Carolina. But outside of that, Stanford's got by far the better defense. I think they have the better coach. North Carolina's last two bowl performances were about as bad as you could get. Maybe they'll be a little bit more motivated here, but I like what Stanford does. They're a very mature team, especially on the road. They have good special teams. They run the football, great defense, 13-3 against the spread their last 16 games away from home, including 5-1 this year. Yeah, I'll lay it now, especially with it under the field goal. I'm not worried as much as everyone else with McCaffrey out. Give me Stanford minus 2.5.
Well, and they've had a lot of time to prep without McCaffrey, too. And the one thing that I've talked about with this game, and I just want to get your thoughts on it as well, and then we'll keep moving on down the card, is that for North Carolina here, I mean, you've got these 15 extra bowl practices or whatever it is that these teams get. And you can plan for a lot of things. You can plan for a lot of stuff in these matchups. What you can't plan for is how physical Stanford is in the trenches. And that's something that you just have to adjust to throughout the game. And North Carolina doesn't see that.
Excellent point. And they don't see that physical superiority too often in the ACC. And let's face it, this North Carolina defense isn't going to wow you when it comes to, you know, I mean, obviously still struggling defending the run, give up 236 yards per game. And one of the more phenomenal stats of this entire football season, a North Carolina defense with exactly, for the entire season, one interception. And it came against an option offense, an FCS team in the Citadel. That's their only interception this entire season. So obviously the North Carolina defense, even with Chizik there, still long ways off from being even a mediocre, in my opinion, FBS defense.
How is that possible? I mean, you figure you would accidentally happen into an interception or two at some point, right?
You would think. I mean, that's the exact wording that I used when I tweeted it out. I don't even know how it's possible to only have one interception for an entire season. You would think an opposing quarterback would, you know, make a misread, or there's a tipped pass at the line of scrimmage that leads to an interception. Just sheer luck, you would expect to get a couple during the course of the season.
Well, let's move to the Music City Bowl here in Nashville, Tennessee, between Nebraska and Tennessee. Of course, a shorter trip.
Wait a
trip
second. You're skipping the Arizona Bowl? You don't want to talk about that one?
No, I'm going chronologically. I'm not going by rotation order. I'm sorry.
We'll talk about it.
Don't worry.
All right.
But this Music City Bowl here, you know, Knoxville obviously closer to Nashville than Lincoln, Nebraska is, but this is a little bit of a destination bowl game. We know Nebraska still travels pretty well based on the fan base that they built up a couple decades ago. So I don't know if we see a really significant crowd advantage in this game, but what we have seen is a pretty significant line move that has pushed Tennessee all the way up to 6.5, and there's a couple sevens out there as well.
Yeah, no question about it. And, you know, I was just giving you a hard time as far as skipping the Arizona Bowl. But, as far as the crowd edge, I only gave about one and a half to Tennessee as far as that. I do think there's a little bit there, and you're staying obviously close to home. So I fully agree with you. I think the markets are probably giving Tennessee 2, maybe even, you know, 2.5 in some instances as far as having the crowd edge. So that's a sharp take by you there. Yeah, I mean, the reason for the line moves, I mean, significant injuries for Nebraska. You know, they lose their second leading tackler as far as suspension. He's the quarterback of the secondary. Wide receiver Jordan Westerkamp, one of their best in the history of the program as far as all-time leader in reception yards and receptions, he's out. And then obviously the most important thing to the line, Tommy Armstrong, being downgraded to doubtful for this one. You know, I think it's overreaction in my opinion because Riker Fife got some starting experience at the end of this year. Keep in mind, Armstrong's hasn't been healthy for the last month of the season. Fife, I could argue, that is probably a better fit for the Mike Riley offense. He's a pro-style guy, so they got a full month of prep with him. You know, Tennessee's defense wasn't a good look, obviously, down the stretch. You look at their final three games of the season, they allowed 629 yards per game, and they weren't playing, the 1999 greatest show on turf. Los Angeles Rams, at that time, St. Louis Rams offense, they're playing Kentucky, Missouri, and Vanderbilt. So I don't think you can lay too many points with Tennessee. I am going to pass on the side of my handicap on the game. I'm stronger more on the over because then Nebraska defense with a key injury could be susceptible. And you look at them, I mean, they gave up 62 to Ohio State, 40 points to that juggernaut known as the Iowa offense. So I'm on the over in this one more than anything. If I get a full touchdown, I'll probably lean with Nebraska as well, Adam.
All right, let's get to the Arizona Bowl because I can tell you're chomping at the bit to talk about it between South Alabama and Air Force. Air Force almost a two-touchdown favorite here in this one. And, you know, obviously the place to start with this game is South Alabama having to figure out how to defend the triple option. We talk about these service academies and how, you know, motivation never really seems to be an issue for them. They're very disciplined. You know, they're going to focus. They're going to pay attention. But you do have to wonder here, with an Air Force team that had higher aspirations, particularly for winning the Mountain West Conference, playing a 6-6 South Alabama team in Tucson, Arizona, it can't possibly be all that exciting for them.
You know, I don't worry about motivation factors for with a an academy team as much as I would worry with anybody else. I mean, I think it's business trips for them. But I mean, with that being said, it's an Air Force team that didn't handle the large favorite role too well. They were 1-6 against the spread as a double-digit favorite this year. They got outright upset on three different occasions and almost got outright upset another time against San Jose State, the second to last game of the season. So they haven't handled it well. South Alabama has been a sneaky team as far as a double-digit dog. I mean, a 3-1 against the spread this year, two outright upsets. They've had some of the biggest upsets in college football the last couple of years, beating San Diego State outright twice, and then obviously in the opener beating Mississippi State outright. You know, the thing that I like with South Alabama is one of the strongest trends, and I'm going to have to, after the bowl season, look this up and go back the last 20 years, but I think teams that entered the bowl season like 0-5 against the spread, have been just a tremendous play on because, I mean, let's go behind the thinking here. You know, the public sees that that team has struggled going into the bowl season. They always like to play against it. That creates some extra line value. So, looking at South Alabama, I agree with your take. I don't think they can stop the option. They haven't proven it time and time again, even though they see it, a time or two each and every year. You know, they play Georgia Southern. They've had games against Navy in the recent history here. Even, Nichols, an FCS team that they played this year, had some option principles, and they struggled there. So I don't think they stop Air Force's option. But with that being said, I can't trust Air Force in this large role here. So I'm going to take South Alabama plus the points and probably sprinkle in an over ticket in pocket for me, Adam.
Well, this should be a good one here on Friday night between Michigan and Florida State. Capital One Orange Bowl. Michigan, a touchdown favorite pretty much across the market here. Different juice based on the sportsbook that you look at. But, man, this is a heavyweight title fight. It's not a game that's in high regard with some people for whatever reason. But this is one that should be a really, really good matchup.
Yeah, no question about it. It's probably one of my – the games, probably three, four games that I'm looking most forward to this entire bowl season. And, breaking down the matchup, I mean, talent-wise, I don't think that there's a touchdown separation between the two teams. Now, I give Florida State's offense the edge. But offensive line maybe a little bit of Michigan there. But, you got Dalvin Cook, I think, is the best offensive player on the field, and obviously he's playing for Florida State. Defensive edge, you obviously got to give the edge, a significant edge to Michigan in this one, and even the special teams edge for Michigan in this one. So you add it all up, they deserve to be favored. But when you start looking at who the teams have played this year, particularly, away from home, I mean, Michigan had a pretty cakewalk, road schedule until they played Ohio State in the finale. And, you exclude the Rutgers game, which I think is fair enough. I mean, couldn't cover against Michigan State on the road, and that's in-state there. At Iowa, they're outright upset. And, they outplayed Ohio State for a majority of the game, but the reality was when they needed to make a play at the end that they didn't. Florida State played a tougher schedule, in my opinion, outside the, conference foes, non-conference games against Mississippi and Florida. Yeah, I mean, obviously they played Clemson. They're on the road in Miami. So a little bit of – and obviously at Louisville. And I think the narrative for Florida State was written in that third week of the season when they lost by 43 to Louisville. After that, I mean, they played, in my opinion, like a legit top 10 team. So, I mean, they lost by a 55-yard field goal on the final play to North Carolina. Probably could have even have beaten Clemson if not for a bad call in the fourth quarter in that one. So I think talent-wise, teams are even. I think coaching-wise, the teams are even. Jimbo Fisher has a ring, keep in mind. Jim Harbaugh doesn't. Add it all up, I think the game should be more in line with 3 or 4 as far as Michigan being favored. I'm going to take Florida State plus the points. And also keep in mind, they're very familiar with this stadium. 7-1 straight up, 7-1 against the spread their last 8 trips here. Upset Miami, put that in quotations earlier here this year. I'll probably even sprinkle in a little bit of Florida State money line. So that's how much I like the Seminoles in this one, Adam.
As an Ohio State fan, I like to hear that. I mean, it would certainly be a nice win for the Big Ten for the Wolverines to get this one, but I can't root for them in any capacity. So, that's just kind of how it goes. How about the Citrus Bowl here? We'll go to Saturday, the final day of 2016. Real interesting one here in Orlando between LSU and Louisville. LSU's a 3-point favorite in this one.
You know, I'm not surprised by it. You know, I go, what I do for each and every bowl game, I go through each and every position and, you know, they give a value. You know, usually it's between 0 and 3 at each position. You know, even with Louisville having the substantial quarterback advantage in this one, you know, I think LSU, I mean, forget Fournette being out. They have a very capable backup who I thought was the better running back for LSU this year, who led them in rushing. So I don't think there's that much of a downgrade there. You know, LSU's got the better defense in this one. Coaching edge obviously has got to go to Bobby Petrino, but LSU played the tougher schedule. The worry I have for Louisville, I mean, yeah, they were great offensively, but they also were very inconsistent, had 31 turnovers. Wow, that's one of the most in the country. And, you know, if there's a team that's built to stop, you know, Lamar Jackson, it's probably LSU. I mean, it's a quick defense, you know, fast to the football. David Randall's probably the best defensive coordinator in the game. So, you know, probably not a big play for me, but I'm actually leaning towards laying it with LSU minus the points in this one. They were a good look, you know, outside of, you know, some red zone issues against Florida. I mean, they were a completely different team and program with Ed Orgeron. And, you know, I got to give them credit after they lost that disappointing loss to Florida. They came right back real strong and didn't miss a beat, especially offensively on the road at Texas A&M on a short travel week. Keep in mind, I was played on Thanksgiving. So it was a good looking football team as soon as they fired Les Miles. And boy, moving forward, I like a lot of what I'm seeing in that program, especially with Dave Aranda staying and Matt Canada being their offensive coordinator. That's about as good as it gets.
I guess the other question to ask then about this game is, where do you see this number going? I mean, it looks a little bit now like we're starting to get a little bit of LSU money creeping into the market, juice back up to minus 115 at the crisp books. Do you feel like we see a 3.5 here? Do you think Louisville's a public dog? Are they a sharp dog? Where do you think this number goes?
You know what? That's a great question. I mean, it's almost like, you know, to be determined, because it's going to depend, you know, how South Carolina and Arkansas look today in the SEC. And if they have two bad performances today, that would make the SEC, you know, off to a very poor bowl start. So I could see then some anti-LSU and SEC money starting to roll in at that point. You know, I'm thinking the public's going to want to play on the Heisman Trophy winner. But, you know, to be honest with you, I could see some split action, at least right now. And obviously, we're going to have to monitor the next 8 bowl games here in the next 2 days on how the dogs continue to do. I mean, if they continue to cash, then, I mean, there might – and keep in mind, this is New Year's weekend here, and it falls on a weekend. So I can tell you matter-of-factly, there are so many tourists in this town, and it started yesterday when I was in a traffic jam at the Welcome to Las Vegas sign on the Strip. So we'll see. I mean, it's going to monitor. The public's very late to the game, so – if the SEC looks bad, I expect some Louisville money to probably roll in. And there could be even more Louisville money come in if the dogs continue to cash.
I mean, as a truck guy myself, I know it's a big-time pain in the ass to sit out there in your truck and watch that gas gauge go down. So definitely my sympathies to you for waiting out there in that traffic. And things can obviously get very bad out there on Las Vegas Boulevard. So, you know, make sure you use those back roads. I'm sure you know that already, but –
well, I was making a shortcut. I thought usually it's not too bad. I mean, you just, you know, I'm making a turn there at the Mandalay Bay. I'm for the most part, if you're not familiar with the Strip, that's, you know, the last casino as you're heading south. So, you know, outside of the Welcome to Las Vegas sign, there usually isn't too much. But, you know, noon on a Wednesday, to have traffic like that there, that did catch me by surprise.
We've got one other 11 a.m. Eastern kickoff to go here, the Tax Slayer Bowl between Georgia Tech and Kentucky. And I guess before we break this game down in particular, and Georgia Tech, 3.5-point favorite, depending on where you look here for this one. How do you handicap this 11 a.m. start? I mean, I know these teams haven't played in a while, so they're on a completely different schedule anyway. But is that still a worry for you?
Yeah, a little bit. Kind of a slow start. I mean, it usually is. It might talk me out of having a significant over ticket. It usually is the case when it comes to the regular season. I don't like playing on high totals on 11 a.m. start times. I just don't do it most of the time now. A lot of times you do get some Big 12 teams playing 11 o'clock start times because of TV purposes. They're in the central time zone, but yeah, I probably, and I can tell you officially, will not have an over ticket here. because of that. But I do think, you know, both teams are should be excited. I think both teams overachieved this year. Georgia Tech, I mean, when they started off, that when they had that three straight losses and were sitting there at 3-3 and they're coming off a 3-9 season, there were some rumblings about Paul Johnson, even though he led them to the Orange Bowl win just a couple years ago. And then I thought, to be perfectly honest with you, I thought Mark Stoops was dead man walking after they lost to Southern Miss outright in the opener, got crushed by Florida, and gave up 42 points to New Mexico State. After that, they go 7-2 against the spread. And obviously, you know, that outright a very good look in the finale, outright upset as a 4-touchdown underdog against Louisville. So, you know, my main handicap here probably comes towards, you know, leaning with Kentucky a little bit, even though I am concerned that their defense, rush defense, is allowing 225 yards per game and 5.1 yards per carry. That's a major concern there. But, you know, believe it or not, I mean, you look at the rush attacks, even though Georgia Tech is an option team, I might even give a slight, you know, edge to Kentucky. They're the team with 2,000 yard rushers here. And actually Georgia Tech averaging 257 rushing yards per game, you know, that would be great for any team out there. But the fact of the matter is it's the lowest out rushing output for a Paul Johnson Georgia Tech team. So, you know, anything above 3, and I got to lean towards Kentucky here plus the points, but their rush defense does concern me a little bit there going up against the option.
Let's go to the Peach Bowl here. One of two college football playoff semifinals, and the big story in the sports betting world is that the sharp players are starting to speak, and they're talking about the Washington Huskies. This number down below 14, really the first time that we've seen that happen. And I have to ask, do you feel like this is a true position type thing here, or is this just a numbers grab of saying, look, it's a playoff semifinal, these two teams can't possibly be that far apart, at least you wouldn't think so. So north of 14 sharp players are going to see what they perceive to be line value, or do you feel like Washington can really hang around here?
Oh, wow. You know, and I think it might be a little misleading because one of the sportsbook guys that I talked to said, actually, a lot of the money is Washington, even though the bigger public money is on Washington. It's not necessarily, you know, sharp money. I mean, I thought Alabama, I thought sharp players took the original position on Alabama when the line opened up early on. And I thought, you know, let's be honest, who's betting, you know, a semifinal bowl game 3 weeks before it's being played? Probably sharper players. I thought they originally drove the line up. So, you know, it's a unique position. I'm kind of a little surprised. I mean, power ratings wise, not surprised. Look, even though I have Alabama graded probably higher than any other team that I've done since I've been doing this in the last decade, and probably by 2 or 3 points, you know, even with that factored in, and even with giving them probably 2.5 points of home field advantage playing in the Georgia Dome, I still think the line probably should be closer to 12.5 or 13, but I'm going to be honest with you. I took anything above 14, and I was taking a Washington stance. If this goes down to 13, I'm going to start getting to the point where I might, you know, buy back my original Washington bet and have a little Alabama ticket in mind, because, you know, going over the teams outside of maybe giving a slight edge of quarterback to Jake Browning and the intangible edge for Washington being a large dog. I mean, Alabama's clearly the better team and by some margin. And then you factor in that they play a tougher schedule. Look, Washington play anyone non-conference wise, and really the only legitimate top, you know, 5-6 caliber team they played, they lost on their home field to USC, and it wasn't a good look. So, you know, I got the right now I would at 13.5, I'm passing on the game. I won't even have a ticket. If that's the number that you were giving me, I won't have a ticket at all. I did give out Washington when they were getting, you know, more than 2 touchdowns. But if the line continues to drop, Adam, you know, I'll have some buybacks. So I'll be honest with you, don't have a strong take on this one at this point. You know, I will say Chris Peterson coached teams. They're 6-0 against the spread when they're dogs with extra time to prep. So he's not chopped liver here. He's not Nick Saban, but he's definitely not chopped liver. I'm intrigued by it because I'm a little surprised to seeing anti-Alabama money. Keep in mind, they've been a big favorite a couple times in playoff and national championship games. Against Notre Dame, you saw how that one turned out. And then last year, they were laying 10 against Michigan State. You saw how that one turned out as well.
Well, we'll go to the other playoff semifinal here. This one between Ohio State and Clemson, Fiesta Bowl in Glendale, Arizona, at University of Phoenix Stadium. So should be a relatively fast track for two offenses that could certainly play up a little bit on the fast track. I think a lot of people looking at the defensive battle here, because both of these defenses have just been phenomenal this season. Ohio State still a 3-point favorite out there. I'm kind of surprised we haven't seen a sharp move on the dog yet.
Well, we've seen some. They ate up all the 3.5s that were out there, and it's you know, talking to the guys here, it's a clear pros versus Joe's game. Public likes Ohio State, sharper tickets like Clemson. That's why those 3.5s were taken away there. We'll see. It'll be interesting because if the Big Ten continues to have a solid bowl season, and you got a lot of tourists in here, you might see some Ohio State money. I can tell you it won't be sharp money because power ratings wise, I got the two teams even. Clemson's got the better offense. Ohio State's got the better defense, and it's one of those times where you like to give – you usually give Urban Meyer a significant coaching advantage. I don't think you can here too much, maybe just a little bit, because while Urban Meyer is the best bowl coach going, 10-2 straight up, 10-2 against the spread, I'll take – as far as the last 5 years, there's no coach I'd rather have as far as prepping a team for a bowl game than Dabo Swinney. 5-0 against the spread in bowl games, 4-1 straight up, and they were all in the underdog role. Keep in mind, he had wins – at least at the time perceived, you know, Les Miles at the, you know, 4 or 5 years ago was perceived to be one of the better coaches. He has a win over him, blew out Bob Stoops back-to-back times, beat, beat Urban Meyer. He handed Urban Meyer one of the losses that he's had, one of the rare ones in bowl action. Then I thought it was a solid performance last season in the national title game against Nick Saban. So hasn't been facing chopped liver and, you know, quarterback edge, in my opinion, obviously to Deshaun Watson. Line of scrimmage edge to Clemson. You look at sack differential, and that's a big one when you're trying to find unique edges for either team. Clemson on the season plus 31 in sacks. You look at Ohio State plus 1. In fact, Ohio State at the end of the season against two legitimate opponents, Penn State and Michigan, minus 11 sacks in those two games. You add all that up, and I got a Clemson ticket plus 3.5 early on. I'd still have a Clemson ticket at plus 3. And I'd have a Clemson money line ticket here. I think Clemson beats your beloved Buckeyes.
Thanks. I'm going to just go ahead and hang up on you now. All right. So we've got 4 more games coming up on Monday. I do want to spend a couple minutes on week 17 of the NFL if I can. So we'll sort of fly through these for Monday's action a little bit. Of course, you can get that Powers Picks newsletter and get some more in-depth analysis. But what do you think about the punt bowl between Florida and Iowa?
Not much. If I'm, you know, just a slight lean at this point on Iowa plus the points, would hope to catch it at 3. It's pretty much not much. I wouldn't have much on it. If you gave me 2.5, I'd probably lay with Florida. If you gave me 3.5, I'd probably like Iowa a little bit more. I got to be honest with you. I really deep dived into that one this morning, and I couldn't come up with much of an edge in that one. So it's good that we're not spending too much time on that one. Don't see a tremendous amount of value.
I have no idea. I'm just going to throw out a random number to you. Over under 10.5 punts in that game.
Ooh, that's a, you know, I would take the over in that one. Yeah, I think I'd be a little light by probably 1.5.
All right. Well, maybe that's something that we'll have to keep in mind. And I don't know, you're going to take any action on that one from your buddies out there if they want to? I mean, you could probably set a better number than
I'll take action from you since you made the line, so – we'll have to have a friendly side bet on that one. You made the line, so, yeah, I'll take action on that one.
I made it off the top of my head, though. I didn't actually do any research on it, so I'd have to come up with a better line than that, I think. All right, how about Western Michigan and Wisconsin in the Cotton Bowl? I mean, this is a game that's not getting a whole lot of play, not getting a ton of love. I sort of wonder about this matchup because if you're Wisconsin, you know, you probably were hoping to get something a little bit stronger in terms of an opponent. But they have a very dangerous opponent that went 13-0 during the regular season in the MAC. And for Western Michigan, I imagine that they probably wanted a different opponent too, because this is not a particularly good matchup for them. And it's not necessarily one of those games where if they won it, you know, sort of like Houston over Florida State last year, where people would go, wow, that's a damn good win.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I, you know, struggling, you know, picking who I'd like against the spread. I think, you know, the 7.5 is about right. I could argue Western Michigan's got the better skill position players. You know, even with Corey Clement at running back, I mean, Western Michigan's got two guys that combined for, you know, over 2,000 yards this year. They got the better quarterback, got the better receiver. Obviously, huge edges at the line of scrimmage for Wisconsin, particularly on the defensive side of the ball. Special teams edge slight to Western Michigan in this one. You know, that motivation is going to be a major factor here. You look at the group of five schools, including the former Big East, 13-5 straight up, 12-6 against the spread in major bowl games since 2004. That's a significant edge. It tells you that they're really hyped for this one. I do think Western Michigan will be hyped. You know, I'm going to pass on the side, lean more towards the over. Wisconsin, sneaky over team, last four games of the season, all went over by about 14.5 points per game over the spread. And I worry about the Western Michigan defense being able to hold up for four quarters against Wisconsin power rush offense. So I'm going to go over the total on that one.
How about the Rose Bowl? USC, Penn State, Southern Cal laying about a touchdown here in Pasadena. That's not really a big surprise. They obviously get a pretty decent home field type of advantage for this one. Can Penn State keep this thing close? I mean, if you look at this game, I think it, in your breakdown as you stack it up, I mean, USC is clearly the more talented team all over the field.
Yeah, and I'm going to lay it with USC. It's their bowl game. You look at them traditionally, and you just look at the Pac. I mean, outside of the 90s, Pac-12 owns the Big Ten in the Rose Bowl, and it's actually come to fruition here even recently, 6-2 straight up, 6-8, or 6-2 against the spread as well the last eight. And USC has been dominating their last four Rose Bowls over the Big Ten teams. So, you know, better, more talented team. I think they are excited and thrilled to be here. They started off the season 1-3, and now they're playing the Rose Bowl. Maybe there's a little bit of, you know, they've said that they're really excited about playing, and I'm sure the players are. I mean, Rose Bowl, nothing's better than the Rose Bowl except the college football playoff. And, you know, Penn State was campaigning pretty hard there after they beat Wisconsin in that one. So, you know, maybe a little bit of slight motivation edge, talent edge to USC, venue, a slight venue edge to them. You add it all up, you know. I would have preferred to be laying 6.5 like I was, like you could have yesterday, but now there's some possible suspensions coming down for Penn State. So I think when it's all said and done, if you want USC, you probably want to bet it now because there's already been a significant half-point line move in that one. But, yeah, give me the Trojans. I'll fight on. Maybe one of my new favorite teams as far as a personal fan. Give me some Tommy Trojan and, you know, run around the Coliseum with the horse there and love their fight song. So me as a fan, I think I'm warming up to really back in this USC program.
And I understand Penn State's campaigning for the college football playoff. And this is an altogether different discussion, but I think it is a point that needs to be said here for Penn State. This is probably the best outcome for them, because if they do go on the road, find a way to win this game, it's a huge win to beat USC. If they go out there and get blown out, people can say, well, they're disappointed about not making the playoff. And, you know, it's certainly understandable, but for them, I mean, what would be the benefit for them in going to the playoff and getting their asses kicked by Alabama? I mean, at least they have a shot in a game like this.
I completely agree with that take. They should be thrilled, and the Rose Bowl should be thrilled to having a Big Ten and a Pac-12 team and two traditional programs. And I think college football fans should be thrilled. I mean, no one wanted to see, and maybe no one wants to see Washington, Alabama. I think the line would have even been more if Penn State were taking on them. So I think it's a win-win on all fronts for fans of both teams, specifically Penn State. I agree with your take on that regard.
All right, let's move over to the NFL here for a couple of minutes. And I think it's good that we only spend a couple of minutes here on the NFL for this week, because I just look at everything that's going on. You have a few games where there's something on the line, a lot of them where there's nothing on the line. What do you do with a week like this in the NFL?
Well, you know, talking to the pro bettors, they actually have more action in this week, because if you do the deep dive, you can find it just like the preseason and sometimes like college bowls, where you have a team that's motivated to play and finish out the season. And you got, even though they're supposed to be professionals, you got teams that are just, they don't care. They want the season. They want to be on the golf course come Tuesday after they heal up a little bit on Monday. So you can find that. Obviously the games are way over inflated, and not that I'd have tickets on the other side, but there's definitely point spread inflation on the teams that have playoff need and the other teams that don't. So, you know, it takes more work, in my opinion. I think there is value in week 17. I think it's Joe Public take to say, I can't put any bets down. But if you're willing to do the homework, then there's some value in week 17, in my opinion. And I'm not afraid to have some bets there when it comes to week 17. So, it just requires, it actually takes me, and I'll just be very candid, it actually takes me probably an extra day of NFL work. There's a lot of times where I just go through it and, you know, put not as much effort as I do into the college side of things, just because college, there's a lot more moving factors. But yeah, I'll say that I probably will have more action this week than most weeks in the NFL, Adam.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, you don't shy away from it when there is a little bit of uncertainty out there, when you're trying to play a little bit of that guessing game and figure out who's invested, who's not, who's ready to, as you said, be out there on the golf course. And, you know, it's tough because, I mean, these guys get beaten up all year long. So you've got a lot of players with some nagging injuries that are being held out. You're probably going to have some late breaking news on Sunday of guys that aren't going to play, of other situations. And, you know, definitely if you do your homework, it's probably the best way to approach this week. But Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com, what is going on over there at the website right now?
Newsletter's red hot, 6-2 last 8 bowl games. I do put out a pick for each and every one of the bowl games. You want the rest of the year for the newsletter, just $39 to cover you for all the remaining bowl games with a pick on each game. You got week 17 in the NFL. You got the entire NFL playoffs, $39 for the rest of the season. And we do the last 2 years combined, every single pick, college and pro, 57% winners. That's not too shabby if you want an early sign-up renewal for next year. Already looking towards next year, that's $69. So $39 for the rest of the season and a very, very low price for next year at $69 for 2017 season. BradPowersSports.com. Click on the store if you want to purchase it. And you can always follow me on Twitter, at BradPowers7.
That newsletter includes your bowl prop bet, or your Super Bowl prop bets too, doesn't it?
Super Bowl prop bets, everything. Anything that's pretty much, for the most part, coming out of the office here in the next 6 weeks. So definitely well worth it. And it's just not a write-up for the bowl games. I mean, you get basically a third of a page with stats, season logs, ATS stats, you name it, you got it. We cover each and every bowl game in depth. And there's still about 20 left on the board.
Well, before I let you go, Brad, I do want to say, you know, 2016's been a pretty exciting year for you, pretty exciting year for a lot of people. And, you know, you and I have become pretty good friends here throughout this calendar year. So I just want to take a second and thank you for all that you do for the show, of course, for your friendship off the air as well, and wish you nothing but the best for 2017, man.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Right back at you, Adam. Happy New Year to everyone out there listening.
There you go. There's Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com. Really, really strong segment there with him. Love to get his college football insight. And, of course, we'll keep him going here through the NFL playoffs and get his thoughts on some of that as well. So we'll shift from the gridiron over to the hardwood. We'll bring in Ralph Michaels from WagerTalk.com. Ralph, how's it going today, man?
Adam, great. How are you?
Doing very well. Appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much for joining us here. And I think the best place to start is with what happened last night, because you and I talked in our first two segments here about how you like to look situationally a lot of the times at college basketball. You look for those good spots to back a team, to fade a team. And we had some spots last night, particularly this Villanova spot, where they survived against DePaul. And they were a 24.5-point favorite on the closing number, won by a bucket. I think that just really, you know, is sort of a personification of what we talk about with situational handicapping in college hoops.
You know, you're the AP number one team. You're at home for Christmas. You're fat and happy. You have a team that you've beaten 8 straight times by 21 points per game, and you have a trip to Omaha coming up this weekend against the AP number 10 team, your main rival in the conference, Creighton. Certainly a situation where you're going to look at the dog. One more aspect that made Julene DePaul is DePaul slows the pace down. This over-under line was 142. DePaul getting anywhere between 24 and 26 points, when you can get 8% of the total over-under number as a live dog, it's a great time to look at that play.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. We talk about correlation a little bit here, and maybe we sort of just do it as a buzzword, but you know, that's an example where it is supported by math. What sort of percentage are you looking for there in terms of that?
You know, it depends. But when you have a live dog, and you have to look at tempo, because remember, 20-point dogs are not the same. If you have a 20-point dog in a game that is a 120 over-under line, it's 1/6 of the line. If the line is 160, it's 1/8. A huge difference in the math. So it depends on the teams. And obviously this situation was unique because of the holiday, because of the letdown, and because of, I mean, because of the look ahead. But, you know, DePaul's a team that, you know, while it looks good on paper, I have to admit I didn't have this play on here because DePaul's a team that's improved greatly. How much they improved was to be seen because they haven't been tested yet. But we saw this past night that they were for real.
Well, now, we talk a lot in this industry about not wanting to overreact to what you've most recently seen. So Villanova with that ugly three-point win at home, and, of course, that was a game that was hanging in the balance late. As you mentioned, they go out to Creighton this weekend. Creighton, meanwhile, had really no issues with Seton Hall. They closed a 7.5-point favorite, won by two touchdowns there in that one. So what do you make of the difference, sort of if you compare and contrast what the two teams did? Do you read anything into it, or is it just, you know, a one-game sample and it is what it is?
A lot of times I use that to my favor. I prefer playing that team off a bad, you know, off a bad effort. And, you know, another example we talked, you know, we'll talk about situationally here and transition into it is the Nebraska game, you know, Nebraska beating Indiana. And what do you make of a team that's off some bad games? Well, Indiana was off some great games. They looked perfect coming into the role. Nebraska, meanwhile, if the listeners were tuned in a couple weeks ago, I talked about Nebraska being last, playing one of the toughest schedules and one of those teams that I'd have my eye on. Well, for the next two games, they were pretty much pitiful. Nebraska lost to Gardner-Webb and then only won by 5 against Southern. But now they got into conference play. They had faced one of the toughest schedules. Indiana had faced one of the weakest schedules. And, of course, Indiana also has the matchup against Louisville on deck Saturday, which is something that they look ahead. Now, that's a rare situation. Rarely do you get a team that has a Big Ten opener at home and may not be as motivated versus a non-conference foe at a neutral setting. But I think that certainly was the case in the Indiana game as well.
Yeah, and for Indiana, I mean, obviously the biggest concern for them is that they gave up 87 points to Nebraska in that game. They were a 13.5-point favorite, really never came close to covering the number, but that was a game where the total opened 142, went up to 144, and these two teams combined for 170 points. So when you look at something like that, obviously there was the look-ahead factor with Indiana, and again, we'll touch on that game here against Louisville coming up this weekend, but is – obviously, when you give up 87 points in a game where the total is 144.5, there's something more to worry about there.
Well, there is. And again, you know, you talk about fat and happy. Indiana was a team that had pulled a couple big upsets. They were off a 47-point win and a 35-point win their past two games. So you lose intensity, and it's much harder to defend than it is to play offense. Defense is reactionary. It takes effort. It takes thought. So when you're lackadaisical, it's the defense that struggles. The offense doesn't. And I think that's what you see after the break.
One more game I want to touch on from last night, and then we'll start looking at some of the other topics here as we look ahead, and that's UCLA and Oregon. So this game, both teams played awful defensively in the first half. And then all of a sudden, they kind of battened down the hatches a little bit in the second half. There were 99 points in the first half of this game, 77 in the second half of it, as things kind of slowed down a little bit with a close game late. But Oregon winds up winning this game at home. Now they've got USC coming to town this weekend. For UCLA, that's a pretty devastating loss. Their first loss of the season, number two team heading into the week. Their ranking's about to drop. But they're going to be a significant favorite in Corvallis coming up here on Friday night against Oregon State, who's been terrible this season. But that's a really quick turnaround. And we talked a little bit earlier in the week about some of these scheduling spots in the Pac-12 where they group you together with you play the Oregon-Oregon State doubleheader, you play the Colorado-Utah doubleheader, those types of things. What do you make of UCLA here in this spot on Friday night?
Well, I'm going to take a step back. In one of the previous segments, UCLA was a team that I said I'm going to look to fade. And I played against them last night. Granted, it's not the way I thought it would work out. But I'll tell you what, you can't be afraid to make a change in your thought process. I had UCLA down a few notches going into conference play. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to erase a few of those because they did impress me last night. So while I thought they might be down, I think they are much better than I may give them credit for. We'll see in a few weeks. But the situation that I look at here, number one, you're going to have a disappointment, obviously. National TV game, your rival, you were up. You were, you know, you came back, you fought back, you were down the first half, you had the lead late, and then you lose on a three-point shot, you know, in the buzzer. But the difference in this game now against Oregon State plays as slow a tempo as anyone. So it's going to be interesting to see how UCLA reacts. Oregon State's going to take 30 seconds off that clock, 25 seconds, pass that ball around. They're not a very good team, but it's going to take UCLA out of their rhythm. So when you have a big favorite, I'm going to look to play against them again in that second game in that turnaround.
I'm curious, you know, looking ahead to Friday here, and like I said, it's a pretty quick turnaround coming off of such an emotional game. What do you put that number at right now with UCLA on the road at Oregon State?
You know, Oregon State was decimated. Oregon State was down to 7 players a few weeks ago. They got one of them back, 8, maybe another one coming back this week. Right about now, I'm going to make UCLA about a 20-point favorite, and I'll be happy to play Oregon State plus anything over about 17.
All right, fair enough. Let's look ahead to this weekend here on New Year's Eve, where you've got Louisville and Indiana, and we've already talked about Indiana a little bit. And for Louisville here, not a great performance for them at home last night against Virginia. Virginia did what they do best. I mean, this game, 114 points. Louisville only scored 53. That's what Virginia does, and they do it better than pretty much anybody in the country. Tony Bennett's done a phenomenal job with this team. So now on Saturday, you have this big blue blood matchup between these two well-known, nationally recognized programs, both of them in bounce-back spots.
Yeah, you know, that certainly wasn't what they were thinking about, but it's a situation where Indiana basically has you know, already knocked off Kansas, knocked off North Carolina. And you got to remember, you know, you can understand Louisville's spot. Louisville's spot was off their upset against Kentucky at home. So that's more of a situation you can understand. I think that Louisville has the edge in this because they have a reason. They have a reason. They can raise their heads and say, okay, we lost this to a team that can be a Final Four, can be a national championship team, and we were in a situation off an upset win. If the Indiana players can't say that, they were embarrassed at home against a team they should have beat. So I think motivationally, the edge goes to Louisville.
Well, and of course, another thing here, and this has sort of been kind of a recurring theme with Indiana, where they bring in a ton of talent, and Tom Crean has his moments, but on the whole, he hasn't really maximized this talent for the Hoosiers. And you know, there's no shame in losing to Louisville. I mean, Louisville's a top 10 caliber team. Sure, this game's at a sort of neutral site there in Indianapolis, but both fan bases should be well represented in this game. But do you think that that's something that starts creeping into Indiana's minds a little bit is, you know, if we don't start winning some of these really big games, then we have to continue dealing with this distraction of people talking about our head coach.
Well, you know, it's a tough situation to be in Indiana. You know, the last 5 years, 27, 20, 17, 29, and 27 wins. So, you know, you saw the 27 and 29 4 and 5 years ago, but you are right. 17 wins 3 years ago, 20 wins 2 years ago. We thought they were back last year with 27. So there has to be some point in time where they make the change. Now, are the fans spoiled? Well, yes. Has recruiting in the Big Ten become much tougher where all of a sudden Wisconsin's getting some major players and Purdue's taking away in-state talent that they haven't in the past? Yes, that's certainly the case. But I think right now you're going to be it's going to be a pretty difficult task to go out and find someone better than Tom Crean. So I think they're sort of going to have to stay status quo for a while.
Well, as we just mentioned, Virginia with that big win there over Louisville on the road. And now Virginia's got another tricky game coming up here against Florida State. And Florida State is a team that you know, a lot of people seem to think highly of here coming into the season. I know another one of our guests here on the show, Kyle Hunter, thought very highly of them. So I know that he's talked about them with me off the air, and I think he mentioned them in passing on the air as well. You have these teams sometimes where people sort of build them up a little bit. They wind up falling short of expectations. Is Florida State going to be one of those teams in your mind?
I don't think so. I think they're a team that people use, coaches and teams use non-conference play in different aspects. If you know you're going to be in the tournament, there's no question you're going to be a number one. You're going to be a number one through a five seed. You use it to work on things in non-conference action. It doesn't mean much. It doesn't matter if you have two losses. It doesn't matter if you have four losses. Your goal is to be better in March. And that's a different mentality that you have to look at it, what these coaches are going into non-conference play. I think Florida State is an excellent team. You know, I'm going to look at Virginia and say this. You know, they played four, now five top 60 teams. And Virginia in the role as a favorite is much different than Virginia as a dog. You know, they played Ohio State at home, Virginia did. They only won by two. They were a double-digit favorite. They played Providence in a neutral setting. They won by 11. They did not cover the spread. They lost to West Virginia at home. So it's tougher to motivate a team when you're expected to win at home. When you're on the road, when you're on the underdog, they get gritty. They play great defense. They shut down opponents. On the flip side, you know, I look at Florida State, and I think it's going to be a low-scoring, physical, defensive game. I figure the line's going to be about 7 or 8, maybe 9 in this game. It could even be 10, but since I like Florida State, I tend to think it's going to be a little on the lower side. But this is a situation where I'm going to fade Virginia as a favorite and play a team that I think is now ready to play conference play, use their non-conference to set them up to get to this position.
How about this? This is something I've always kind of wondered about, and I like to get different opinions on it. So Virginia gets that big win. You know, and a lot of people watch that Kentucky-Louisville game. It's one of the greatest rivalries in college sports. And people were tuned in, and people were engaged, and it was a game that certainly didn't disappoint. Then people watch what Louisville did against Virginia. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you're Virginia – do you get a little bit of a bump in the number because, you know, people saw what Louisville did to Kentucky, then people saw what you did to Louisville. So, you know, maybe that line does get inflated a little bit based on public perception, the expectation of public action. You know, is that something that you subscribe to?
Well, it's certainly, you know, Vegas's job. And, you know, Matt Holt and I are friends and we talk a lot. Matt, the vice president at Cantor Gaming CG Technologies, you know, he always talks about that all I do is put a number where I'm going to get 50-50 money. So, yes, the public looks at Virginia. They beat Louisville. More public money is going to come in on Virginia. So, obviously, the line gets inflated. The line doesn't get inflated because Virginia's any better because they beat them. It's because the Vegas sports books are going to get more money, and that's our job as a handicapper is find the value where there's a difference between how the teams are on the court and what the perception of the teams are in the public and with the lines posted at the sports books.
So Indiana, Louisville, not an example of this, but Florida State and Virginia is where we've basically transitioned for the most part away from non-conference play. Now it's almost exclusively conference action until you get to the bracket busters or some kind of thing like that. Maybe you have the off non-conference game. How does your handicapping, how does your mindset change transitioning from the non-conference action to conference play?
Usually, I'm going to say it's pretty much 3 points to the underdog. I think there's familiarity. I think there's a pattern. You get into practice patterns. If you're the Ivy, you play Friday night and Saturday. If you're the Big Ten, you play, you know, Wednesday or Tuesday, you know, with sometimes an occasional weird game, and Saturday. You get into a routine, you get into your pattern, and you become a better team. And while your practices are now more important, your practices are making you a better team. You're not spending as much time looking at film and breaking down players because you've played against them twice each of the last several years. Obviously, if you're a freshman, that's not the case. But a lot of the juniors have already seen these kids, and the film is less time spent on. You're going over your mechanics. You're going over your defense. You're putting in new plays on offense, and I think you improve. But the familiarity, the situationals of having played in those visiting venues, being familiar with them, having stayed in the same hotels if it's an overnight trip. So I think I always change my home court edge. But let's downgrade that to maybe 1.5 or 2 points towards the dog when I'm looking at these games.
Well, and I think another part of it then, too, is we've talked about this a little bit. I talked about on last week's segment with you some teams that are overvalued and undervalued a little bit based on what they did during the non-conference portion of the season. So with that in mind, is this one of your favorite times of year as a handicapper because you can prey on some of those perceptions that are a little bit out of whack?
Yeah, you know what? We didn't talk about this earlier, but I came up with a situational play for this weekend's games and walk you through it and explain why. You know, East Carolina is a team this year that's 9-5, a decent record for them. But they've played one of the weakest schedules. They played the 349th schedule. That is almost last of the 351 teams. They played three top 10 teams. And of those three teams, they lost by 17 points per game. The rest of their nine games they've played were all teams ranked 180 or higher. So basically, you're the bottom half of the league. SMU comes in. Something else I want to mention for this week. Remember, when kids are making back-to-back road trips this week, it's not nearly as taxing because they're coming home, they're relaxing, they're practicing, they're not going to classes, they're not having to study. SMU just went up to Memphis, flew back home, flying out to East Carolina. While I might downgrade them a point or two off a back-to-back road trip, this time I'm not. There's no negative for having a back-to-back. But the important thing is, looking at who Memphis played so far this year, when you look at the lineup of, who East Carolina has faced this year, you look at the teams that they've played, you collectively look at the defenses East Carolina has played, and they average 306th in the nation, meaning they haven't faced any top 50 defense yet this year. SMU is a great defense. They're number 28 in KenPom's adjusted defense. They just went to Memphis, held Memphis to 54 points on Tuesday night. Now they're going to get East Carolina, and I think they're going to completely shut East Carolina down. East Carolina, 9-5 record, non-conference play, decent scoring team playing nobody. Now they're going to get into conference play, face a great team that has had a lot of motivation to go to the next level, and I think they shut them down.
One other thing I'll ask you about conference play here, and then there's another topic that I want to get into to wrap up today's segment, is, you know, with 351 teams, we see a lot of coaching movement each and every year. And we see teams that say, you know, hey, we're going to push the tempo. We want to do this. We want to slow down the tempo because we have this. Some teams lose a big guy and they realize, well, you know, without so-and-so, we should probably speed up the pace a little bit because now our skill is out on the perimeter, so we don't have to worry about tiring out our big man. You have all these teams that are making these transitions here, and a lot of these teams, as you mentioned, you know, use the non-conference portion of the season to make those adjustments to get comfortable in some of these different schemes, different plays, whatever the case may be. Now that we get into conference play here, how do you look at some of those situations with new coaches? I realize all of them are different because, you know, some teams are going faster, some teams are going slower, whatever the case may be. But a lot of times these coaches are going to find out that, you know, hey, I want to speed things up, and then they do it in conference play, and it doesn't work for them at all. So how do you sort of handicap that element of it?
You know what? There's no secret element to that, and I don't have an answer to that. It's basically wait and see. You know, coach speak is coach speak. What you do in non-conference is what you do in non-conference. But until you see those players lace it up in conference play, you don't know what that coach is going to do. So I never assume. You know, don't assume with my money. Don't assume with your money. I have to wait and see. So if there's a question and I'm not sure what the coach is going to do, it's just basically a pass for me. Until you know what he's going to do, write those notes down that what you think he's going to do, and then next time, it's important to keep notes on coaches. So this year, if he said he wants to press the tempo in conference play and he's a first-year head coach, and he does press the tempo, he gets a check mark that you can you have one lean where you're going to trust him what he says next time. So next time if he gets into March Madness and you say, we've got to change our defense totally, we're getting outplayed, we don't have the manpower, I've got to go to zone, you know you can believe with what he's going to say. So unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you on that one because it's nothing I ever guessed on what they're going to do.
Last topic I want to ask about here, and as I've had different handicappers on the show throughout the year and as I've had them my time hosting on Bang the Book Radio, I always like to get a feel for bankroll management practices because everybody's different. We have some guys on the show here who are very, very selective. They're only going to play games when they have big edges. We have other guys that are high volume where they feel like a lot of smaller edges can lead up to, you know, a lot more profit, a lot more victories. So I just want to get your thoughts on it. You know, what's the approach that you tend to have to bankroll management? Because, you know, like some of our other guests, you've been in this industry for quite a while. You've seen it change. You've seen it adapt. You know, you've had to do some adapting yourself. But what would you recommend to our listeners about how to manage a bankroll?
You know what? It's consistency, and consistency can be one of two things. You know, there's a lot of sharps that I know and you and I both know that play the same on each game, and that's important. There's a lot of people that play with star ratings, and I happen to use star ratings. But the important thing to remember with star ratings is you have to put a value on your best game and your worst game and how much difference there is. When I'm handicapping a game, and what I tell my customers is this, if I go 2-1, you should win money. You should never lose money going 2-1, 67%. So personally, I use a 3-, 4-, and 5 star rated basis. During football, I suggest customers play 1% per unit. So if you're starting football with a $10,000 bankroll, my suggestions are you play 1% or $300 on a 3-star. If you have a $1,000 bankroll, you're going to play $30 on a 3-star, $40 on a 4, and $50 on a 5. So you are consistent. You're playing within 60% gap of your numbers, and you're never wagering more than 5% on your bankroll on one game. Excuse me.
So when you're looking at that, at the 3-4-5 type of layout or something similar, you know, maybe it's somebody that goes 2-3-4, whatever the case may be, you know, what, I don't know if you do a whole lot of derivative betting. If you do like to look at first half, second half, live betting types of lines, you know, what would be your bankroll management theory then with something like that? Because you know as well as I do that in a lot of ways, that's what the industry is going towards. It's going toward, you know, playing some ARB. It's going toward middling halves, you know, live betting, of course. So what sorts of bankroll, you know, management tips would you have in that regard?
You know what? I'm not the best person to ask in this. I'm just starting to transition into that. Now, the difference is if you're betting for yourself, you can get those numbers and you can find it. If you're handicapping for other people, your customers aren't going to be able to find those same numbers at those same times, so it's difficult to handicap to those customers and get them their plays. Certainly there's tech services and there's services that are going to come to it, but I think what the industry is going to come to this, and this is something I've envisioned in the past, and I think it's almost going to come down to a stock market approach where the head of the fund can make those halftime first quarters, you know, middling the games and people taking a percentage of what that fund is. So, you know, to me, I'm not a great person to ask on that. I just came out to Vegas recently, having, you know, spent all my time at North Coast and Power Sweep. The halftimes first quarters are new to me, something I've gotten into this year, but not enough to talk about what people should do in respect to how to play those games compared to a game or a total or a season prop.
Well, and I do think that that's a good lesson for our listeners because you have been in this industry for a long time, but if it is something that you're not necessarily accustomed to, you are going to crowdsource some of those opinions from friends that you trust, or, you know, you're going to dip your toe in slightly rather than just jump straight into the pool. And I think that, you know, that level of humility, that level of really, you know, of common sense of knowing, you know, hey, this isn't the best investment for my bankroll. I mean, I think that's an invaluable lesson for our listeners to learn and to comprehend.
You know, every bet doesn't fit every person. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not personally doing them now, learning as I go, and certainly something I will continue to grow on and share with my customers. But at this point, it's nothing I want to give insight to because I'm still learning as I go.
Well, Ralph Michaels of WagerTalk.com, what's going on over there at the website right now?
You know, it's just a great week with conference play. You know, we have a special, any bangable customer that wants to take the month of January, I'm going to do hoops and football as a special to your customers for just $200. Email me at calsports@aol.com. And, Adam, I always have to butt my nose in when listening to other people. I love Brad Powers. His newsletter is awesome. His college handicapping is great. You guys talked about this week in the NFL. I'd like to interject just one thought that I think is very important when you get to this week. I'm friends with a few ex-NFL players. A team like New Orleans that sits at 7-8 is a huge difference to those players. A proud franchise, playoffs the last few years, Peyton as the coach, Breeze as the quarterback. When you're 7-8, it doesn't matter if you're out of the playoffs or not. It doesn't matter if you're home or away. You don't want to finish at 7-9 when there's an 8-8 possibility for you to start golfing on Tuesday, as Brad said, and that's my suggestion.
There you go. Ralph Michaels on Twitter at CalSportsLV. Ralph, appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, again, best wishes to you and yours as we wrap up 2016, and we'll talk to you again in the new year.
Happy New Year to all the listeners. Thank you.
Well, good segment there with Ralph Michaels. Keep in mind here, our Bang the Book Radio listeners can head on over to DSI Sportsbook, use the promo code BTB Radio. They'll get you a $10 free bet just for signing up, an additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. Tons of stuff going on right now with the bowl games, with week 17 of the NFL, NHL, college basketball now into conference play. And of course, our last segment for today with Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com to talk about UFC 207. Jay, what's happening, man? How are you?
Hey, Adam, how you doing? Happy holidays to you.
Same to you, man. Glad to have you back on the air here. And, you know, we got a pretty interesting event to talk about to wrap up 2016. And it's been a year here in UFC where we've had a ton of events. If I remember correctly, you said that they're going to kind of shrink that down a little bit for next year. But on the whole, overall here, overall view of 2016, and I've asked a couple of other guests about this, and I want to ask you here, what would be some of your New Year's resolutions for betting UFC in 2017? Are there some things that maybe you overlooked, some things that you didn't put enough value in? You know, what do you think you're going to try to improve upon for next year?
Yeah, definitely a few things. One, continue to take a look into fighters, you know, before, you know, all the, you know, the USADA and the drug, you know, anti-doping and post anti-doping, you know, take a longer look and a deeper dive into how fighters have performed before and after and how fighters that have struggled in that regard. That's definitely one of them. You know, pay a little closer attention to interviews as well. Definitely finding some nuggets here and there. Just mentality heading into fights, you know, switching of fight camps, really understanding what that fully means, as opposed to just, you know, taking fighters at face value. There's always things you can learn. And, you know, just the more time you put into each individual bout, the more you're going to learn. It's certainly a lot more than, you know, what physically one fighter can do versus what another fighter can physically.
Well, let's look here at this UFC 207 card, and everyone already knows the big story about this one. Ronda Rousey returns. She's down to a minus 140 favorite here against Amanda Nunes. I don't remember what this line was when we talked a couple weeks ago, but doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of support out there for Ronda in the marketplace.
Yeah, I think that's kind of understandable. I think when we last talked, Rondo was maybe about minus 165, minus 160, or plus 40 return back on Amanda Nunes. I think this line opened with Ronda Rousey is over a 2-to-1 favorite, and it certainly dropped about a dollar. So pretty significant movement towards Amanda Nunes. And I think the biggest thing this week is Ronda's unwillingness to talk to the media. She doesn't want to talk to anyone pretty much before the fight. She's basically staying on her own. She literally just weighed in a couple minutes before this segment. She made weight. I mean, physically she looks great, but I think this fight honestly is just going to be a referendum on her mentality. You know, physically both of these fighters have ways to win. You know, Ronda, she gets the fight to the ground. I think she's a very good opportunity to win via submission. Even though Amanda Nunes is a black belt in jiu-jitsu, Ronda Rousey's armbar technique is as good as anyone's on the ground, and her propensity to win by submission probably in the top three of the sport. So super high level there, super high ability to win by submission. And on the feet, Amanda Nunes is probably the most powerful striker in this weight class. You know, she's won the majority of her bouts by knockout. She can certainly hurt Ronda on the feet if there's an extended standing exchange. But honestly, I think you throw all of that out the window. And it really comes down to Ronda's mentality. If she's just mentally checked out, which I think some people believe she is, I think she's one of more of like the bully mentality, where when she's super confident and she's, you know, a front runner, she dominates her opponents. But now that she's faced adversity, and you know, her confidence is nowhere near what it was prior to this loss, it's a real question mark how she's going to fight in this in the octagon. I think that's really what it comes down to. How do you foresee that? I think if she loses this fight, I think she retires almost on the spot. I don't see her returning to the UFC. If she wins, then, you know, we'll probably see a couple more fights from her. I just think she takes losses harder than just about anyone else I've ever seen fight in the sport. So pretty significant in that regard. Will this end inside the distance? Absolutely. Neither of these fighters is known for their endurance. And in a 5-round fight, I just don't see this, you know, regardless of Ronda's mentality of this going the distance. I mean, I think the line is 10-1 for the fight to end in the distance. So pretty much a guarantee. You know, I lean towards Amanda Nunes to win, because I just don't see Ronda being able to handle, you know, this whole situation. Like just her mentality heading the fight, not talking to anybody, just, you know, is just a big red flag to me. So, you know, if you have to bet this fight, I would say Amanda Nunes by knockout. I think that's the most likely outcome. But, you know, just, you know, even a slip or a fall from Amanda Nunes and Ronda gets a hold of her arm, even if she's checked out, I mean, she could still win by armbar. So definitely a tricky side to bet in this fight. You know, very intriguing fight. And, you know, like I said, it's really going to be a referendum on Rousey and her career.
Maybe this is a wild hypothetical. Maybe there's really no reason to come up with this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I was thinking about it. All things considered equal, let's say Ronda Rousey, you know, didn't lose that fight to Holly Holm. Let's say that she's been fighting, you know, throughout. From a pure talent standpoint, you know, if Ronda was in the right mindset, if, you know, she had been fighting, had been training, all that type of thing, where would a number like this have been?
Yeah, I mean, it probably would be, you know, at least a couple dollars more than what it is now, without a doubt. But, you know, just in general, I mean, I've thought for probably a couple of years now that Nunes was the biggest threat to Rousey because of the punching power. I mean, Ronda herself is one of the more powerful strikers in the weight class, but no one's going to be beating Ronda on the ground, so it would require somebody to beat her up on the feet and knock her out. I mean, Holly did that, but of the fighters in this weight division currently, Nunes is always going to be a threat because she has one punch knockout power, which is really rare in this weight class. So, I mean, this was even with Ronda's if she had, you know, been on a tidal wave of confidence and wins, I think this was, you know, always going to be a, you know, a more difficult fight for her. You know, certainly has an ability to win, which, you know, which I've already discussed, but, you know, definitely a tricky bout. And, you know, thinking about mentality and confidence, which I think are really low heading to this bout. I think this is going to be difficult for her. Like I said, I think she's kind of checked out, and if she loses, I'd be absolutely shocked if she returns to the sport.
Well, before we get to Ronda's return, we've got a really good bantamweight fight here for the belt between Cody Garbrandt and Dominic Cruz. Cruz a -210 favorite right now at DSI Sportsbook. Is that line pretty accurate here? Do you feel like the chalk holds up, or do you like the live dog?
I like the favorite here. The thing with Garbrandt is he's fought 10 times, nine wins by knockout. There's talent here for sure, but he trains alongside other fighters who've already lost to Dominic Cruz. He's trained with Team Alpha Male, TJ Dillashaw, who's no longer there but had been there for a long time. That's where he got his start of his career. And Uriah Faber, who's been the head of Team Alpha Male for, you know, since its inception. So Dominic Cruz has basically built a career, and especially this year, this is the year of Dominic Cruz's dominance over Team Alpha Male. He's already beaten Faber and Dillashaw this year, and I think he's going to do the same with Garbrandt. The thing with Dominic Cruz is his movement and just his footwork is just better than everybody else's. He's extremely hard to hit. He has 75. He has a striking. I forget the exact number. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 75% striking defense, meaning that of every four strikes his opponent throws, his opponent only lands one. He's super hard to hit. I think he ranks number one in the history of the UFC of anyone who's ever had more than five fights in the organization in terms of their ability to defend strikes on a percentage basis. So that tells you a lot of what Dominic Cruz brings to the table. He moves in, he moves out, he's coming from different angles, he switches stances. A fighter throws a strike, he just completely hits air. And I think that's where Garbrandt's going to get really frustrated in this bout. He's going to really struggle, is that he's never faced anybody like Dominic Cruz before. Garbrandt, for a fighter who's fighting for a title, is relatively green. Best fighter he's faced is Thomas Almeida, who's a prospect himself in this weight class and only, you know, in his early 20s. So facing a guy of Dominic Cruz's skill set, experience, and ability is just going to be too much. I think he's just going to struggle to make contact with Dominic Cruz. He is a power puncher, but he's going to be throwing these shots that he's just going to be hitting air. Dominic Cruz is going to be in and out, and he's just going to beat him with volume. And it's going to continue to frustrate Cody Garbrandt. So I think Dominic Cruz wins this fight, and he's going to do so clearly. Dominic's not a power striker. So I think this is going to go to the scorecards, and Dominic's going to win maybe 4-1. It's going to be a clear decision. So Dominic Cruz by decision, I think, is about +135 or so. That's a viable option. But also the Dominic Cruz point handicap, -5.5, is also around -130, -140. So that covers you either by, a wide decision or by, a finish, which, you know, isn't out of the realm of possibility. But, it just covers you in case there is a finish by Cruz in this bout. So both of those, I think, are, you know, likely winners.
Well, there have been some things going on here in the lead up to this fight, some spats in the media between these two guys. Is that anything that's altered your handicapping thoughts at all for this fight?
No, I think it's actually enhanced it. There was something that came out, I think it was yesterday, the day before, interview, and Garbrandt couldn't even handle Dominic Cruz's banter, had to walk out of a room. He is a bit of a hothead, and I think Dominic Cruz is probably in his head as well. Garbrandt is a young guy, 25 years old, first title fight. It's a lot to overcome and for a guy who's never been beaten. So, sometimes, fighters need this type of loss, just kind of, potentially being, just outschooled by, an incredible veteran. I mean, Dominic Cruz is 22-1 in his own right, hasn't lost in 10 years. So people tend to forget just how good Dominic Cruz is. His record speaks for itself. So I think Garbrandt's, just doesn't have the technique, and he's losing the mind games as well. So not a good combination heading into this fight.
Well, the other bantamweight fight on the card here, looks like the winner of this one will have an opportunity to get a shot at the bantamweight title. John Lineker, TJ Dillashaw. Dillashaw is a minus 240 or so favorite, minus 230, minus 240 out there. Does this one play out the way that the line would suggest, or you feel like Lineker, you know, can pull off the mild upset here?
Yeah, this is a little bit tricky. It's kind of similar to, the fight we just talked about. I do think this is the best fight on the card, though. It is intriguing because John Lineker's style and just his, just entertainment value is as high as anyone's in the UFC, because he just stands there and just throws heavy, heavy punches. That's his style. He comes at you like a battering ram and tries to take your head off or, take your kidneys out. He's very fun and entertaining to watch. The difference here in this fight, though, is, Dillashaw does, used to train at Alpha Male, and now he trains at Duane Ludwig in Colorado. Definitely improved his technique since leaving Alpha Male. His game is really revolved around movement and moving to create strikes. That's the difference between him and Lineker, is speed and movement. Lineker, could he knock out TJ Dillashaw? Absolutely, he can knock out anybody in this weight class. Biggest power in this weight class, but he doesn't. He comes at you rather slowly. His hands aren't fast. It's powerful, but you can kind of see it coming. It's just, he just doesn't stop. Dillashaw himself doesn't stop, but he moves and he hits. So I think Dillashaw is going to see Lineker's strikes coming, and he's going to land on the counter. And that's going to be his way to win. John Dodson kind of had his down when they fought, earlier in the year against Lineker, and he was able to avoid the strikes. It was just he was a bit too inactive with his strikes in order to really capitalize and, win a full decision on the scorecards. That fight went to a split decision. Dillashaw much more active from an offensive standpoint. So I think Dillashaw is going to move in and out and avoid Lineker's big shots. He's just going to be able to see them coming, and he's going to be prepared for that. And then Dillashaw wins this fight. I'm going to say by decision as well. Lineker, his chin is just amazing, extremely hard to finish. So I see TJ getting to the scorecards here and winning a decision.
Well, let's bounce around a little bit. We covered the top three fights here on the card, at least, from a scheduling standpoint there with the main card. But what else do you like on this one? Any really strong bets that stand out?
Yeah, I like Brandon Sash. Really early on the card, I think it's the second fight on the card. He's facing a guy named Nico Price. Sash has lost, I think, three straight bouts in the UFC. So this is a fight he needs to win. He's facing a newcomer who, he has a little bit of a wrestling game, but I just don't see his opportunity to take down Brandon Thatch. Thatch doesn't have great takedown defense, but he's big for the weight class, and he's facing someone now who's really inexperienced and really, really hittable on the feet and susceptible in the clinch. That's where Thatch is at his best, landing knees and elbows. I think he wins this fight, and he's going to finish Nico Price. I'm surprised at this price. I thought he was probably going to be about 3-1 in this bout, and I've seen him as low as minus 180 or minus 180, minus 175. So that's a pretty good price on an experienced fighter facing a relative novice. I think that lands good parlay piece.
So if that's a good parlay piece, then I presume there has to be something else that would go on that parlay, right?
Yeah, Dominic Cruz is definitely a viable option. I really do like him in this bout. Another fight that's interesting is the Lewis Smoka-Ray Borg fight. Lewis Smoka, coming into this fight, I've heard a couple interviews, doesn't sound confident at all, doesn't really prepare much for opponents. He's also switched camps. He doesn't watch a lot of tape to study his opponents. I think that's, just a bad omen. And a guy who's really gone, by on athletic ability as opposed to mental sharpness. So I like Ray Borg here in that bout. He's minus 135 currently. He was even money, about a week ago. So that kind of showed that, the betting public, agrees with my sentiment there on that fight. Another fight that's interesting to me is the Johnny Hendricks-Neil Magny fight. Magny currently minus 120 with the comeback on Hendricks plus 110. So pretty evenly lined fight. Hendricks, his mentality, he's been talking about potentially about retirement as well, which is another red flag. Never want to bet on a fighter talking about retirement. That's almost always a recipe for disaster. He was top of the world, just 2 years ago being welterweight champion. He's fallen kind of on hard times, struggled to make weight several times. I haven't heard if he's made weight yet for this bout, but, that's always a definite concern. Magny, extremely good endurance, really long for the weight class. He's got an 11-inch reach advantage, so a massive, massive physical advantage. Hendricks, great wrestler, though, so he could take down Magny, but is Hendricks going to struggle, as the fight progresses? That's where Magny kind of does his best work, is when he tires his opponents out, forces them into a, pushes their conditioning, and then Magny takes over. He trains out of Colorado, former military, really, really good cardio, just turns it on late fight. So I think that's a really difficult fight for John Hendricks. And I like Neil Magny to get the W there, just outworking a smaller opponent who, kind of like Rousey, I think, kind of checked out at this point.
Last thing I ask you about, I know that we've had on some of these recent segments some pretty good underdog plays that have come through for us. But in looking at this card, for one thing, there aren't a whole lot of big dogs. Biggest dog right now, Lineker at the plus 195. Not really a whole lot of those that stand out here, huh?
No, there's not. There's a lot of closely lined fights. One underdog that I haven't played yet that I think, could win is Mike Pyle. He's plus 160 currently against Alex Garcia. Pyle, though, really old, doesn't have the greatest of chins. And that's a concern against Garcia, who does have heavy hands and could potentially knock out Mike Pyle. But Pyle, pretty smart fighter. Just has a lot of tools, to work with. Really, really solid veteran. I think you could get it done against the relatively inexperienced Alex Garcia, who mentally, hasn't had the best game plans in his fight. So I think, this price is a little high. It should be closer to even money than the plus 160 it currently is.
Well, excellent insight here for this final event of 2016 from Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com. What's going on over there at OddsBreaker right now?
Yeah, all sorts of content. I have fight breakdowns on the main event, the co-main event, and the Lineker-Dillashaw fight as well. There's also one on Alex Oliveira and Tim Means, which that's a good one to read. You can see that play over at MMA Odds Breaker. I also have a newcomer breakdown on Nego Price. So anyone who's not familiar with MMA Odds Breaker, I do all their new fighter breakdowns. I have a 10 attribute grading system, and I grade fighters from an A to an F, essentially, just kind of like a grade school grading system. And that's kind of how I do my power rankings from A to F. So, compare fighters. So always check those out, especially the newcomer breakdowns. There's usually not a lot of good content out there for these new fighters. So that's a really, that's a really good source if you're trying to research some of these debutants.
Well, you can find Jay on Twitter at Jay Primetown, and of course at MMA Odds Breaker on Twitter. Jay, appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much. Hope you enjoy the new year, and we'll talk to you again in 2017.
Yeah, absolutely. Got a week off next week, and then we got another UFC the week after that in Phoenix. Have a happy new year, Adam.
Well, good stuff there from Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com. Coming up on our final show of 2016, we will have our final Westgate Super Contest selection segment with myself and Cole Ryan. And then also Brent from DSI Sportsbook with the odds report. We'll talk about college football playoff semifinals, the remaining bowl games, also week 17 of the NFL. So thank you so much for joining us, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.